So I've been asked to give some sort of reflection, and establishing that presence of here and now, to because this is timeless Dhamma of being present, and then the future is the unknown, the past is a memory. So that, I mean, that needs to be constantly reflected upon, because as I was saying yesterday, the world we live in, the society, is all very much reality is time, and self is our realities. Practice for liberation, we're going against the whole momentum of the conditioning of our societies and attitudes of the world. Because it's like the world believes in the future and past and the self this sense of history and progress are very much part of, like, the Western way of thinking. History is real, and progress is good. So we notice in Europe, for example, where the economies have been suffering, and in the United States, this idea of progress is being challenged, because we're supposed to just progress, and progress always means, you know, getting better and better, better and better, better and better. But that's not the way conditioned phenomena operates. It has, it rises, reaches its peak, and then it goes the other way, degenerates. And so this is, just reflecting on the natural conditions that we're experiencing through the body, through the mind. The penny drops, it actually begins to register in your consciousness that you're not really what you think, or that life isn't, you can't expect life to always be getting better and better and progressing and everything improving, because that's not the way things are in terms of the reality of Dhamma. So the disappointments, the disillusionments, the other side of the spectrum is one that the Buddha pointed out very clearly in his teaching, that there's suffering, old age, sickness, death, because this side of life tends to not be, what we want to hear or what we want to happen to us. We would like even false promises, empty promises of everything getting better and staying young forever and living forever and conquering illness and making a perfect society where everybody is filled with love and harmony. But this is not the way it is. This realm we're living in is not that kind of a realm. It's a realm of birth and death, and of relentless, incessant changingness, of pleasure, pain, and of loss. We all have to lose. And so in monastic Samanasanya reflections, that all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. This is, we chant this every day, a mind, say, that is bent on everything beloved and pleasing, I'll be able to keep forever. Which is definitely an American way of life, the promises of happiness. for the future. So in the present moment, you know, the whatever way you're feeling, or, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, the awareness of it is you're aware, you're putting awareness, cultivating awareness of the way it is. So then we can, you know, we can bear with old age, sickness, death, and loss. These are bearable conditions. We have to. They're part of this realm. And we can also, when we're mindful, be aware of happiness and pleasure and sensory delights and things without being grasping and wanting them and trying to keep them, or keep spending our lives seeking happiness through, you know, wanting it and desire and ignorance. But we find this inner stillness through mindfulness, in which then the world arises and ceases, and things change according to their nature, and we're no longer identified with the changing conditions. We lose that identity of I am this body and this person. So in my own life as a monk, this is continuous reflection on the here and now and the observing of my own emotional state or physical and reactions to physical, you know, like sensory impingement or heat and cold or pleasure, pain experiences through the body, and of course through the emotions, the praise and blame and success and failure that one experiences as an individual in any human situation. So these eight worldly dhammas, Ajahn Chah is very always talking about the eight worldly dhammas, which are, you know, like good fortune or bad fortune. Each one has the four positive and four negative, and its opposite, the four negative. Good fortune, bad fortune, high status, low status, praise and blame, happiness and suffering. And then he would encourage us to look at that in our minds. You know, the when we're being praised, it's like this. When we're being criticized and blamed, it's like this. When we're happy, if we're feeling happy and the world is wonderful, it's like this. When it's miserable and horrible, it's like this. And that which is observing, you see, is the actual escape hatch from the relentless, incessant changingness of the eight worldly dhammas that we all have to live with in a lifetime as a human being. So, seeing things as they are, dhamma is not about making everything perfect, about trying to create ideal situations, endlessly seeking happiness or success and good health and good fortune and whatnot, or having high, being respected, being admired, and being looked up to, because your status is high. We all, one of the great fears most of us have is like being looked down on or despised or rejected or having misfortunes, unfortunate things happening to us, or being criticized, blamed. And like in England, for example, it's a very blaming culture. Anything goes wrong, they want to immediately look for somebody to blame. And why anybody would want to be Prime Minister of Britain, I don't know. I think they're masochists. But then I see that myself, you know, something goes wrong, who's to blame? The first reaction. And then so you either look for somebody, you know, it's your fault, or you can say, well, I'm to blame. Some people always blame themselves, others are always seeking someone else to blame. But this blaming thing is in society, living in monastic communities or wherever, it's the way the world operates, praise and blame. And so when you are blamed, then use that to see what it's like, see how your emotions react to being criticized or blamed for something. And especially for something you haven't done. I mean, that's really where I could really get very angry and indignant is when I'm blamed for something I haven't done. And then I get this thrill of righteous indignation. But then in terms of mindfulness and gamatan and meditation, you're using situations the way, you know, what we call our vipaka kamma, or like right now at this moment, this is a vipaka kamma of being born for each of us. We're it's here and now, we're sitting here in this room, and it's like this, and we feel whatever way you're feeling, and your physical condition, whatever that is at this moment, is like this. And then people say, and I remember people saying, why, what did I do to deserve this? You know, something unfortunate happens, and I said, well, you were born. If you were never born, you wouldn't have such a problem. One time at Chithurst years ago, one of the supporters, a young woman who just had a baby, you know, and she came one Sunday morning all upset carrying her baby, and he has had terrible coughing fits all night. And she's just totally kind of anguished about this, wanting, you know, seeing her beloved child in this wretched state of coughing, in continuous kind of fits of coughing. And so she said, what did he ever do to deserve this? So I told her, he was born. Years later, I met an adult man now, and I said, do you remember that? He says, I don't even remember it. He had no knowledge of it. And that's like in living with somebody like Ajahn Chah, I found, because being American, you are conditioned to, with ideals, you know, you're very idealistic, and so it was, and a strong sense of individual self, you know, so I tended, when I was in university, they used to call me Mr. Outer Space, because my head was always up in the clouds, and I didn't know where my feet were usually. That's why I have foot problems in old age. And so the head up in the clouds ideals, you know, why it was very idealistic. And that part of me was, you know, quite beautiful in its way, but it also blinded me, because I was always criticizing everything, because, you know, I knew how it should be, but I didn't, most of the time, I didn't ever like the way things are, because I always find something wrong with it, and especially myself. So then going to live in northeast Thailand, which it was in those days very backward part of Thailand, undeveloped and agrarian, rice farming, communities. And so coming out, you know, from being a city boy to living in forest monasteries near villages, which were, you know, they had no electricity or anything. They were all very primitive in those days. But the attitude of the Thai farmers, the Thai village people, plus Ajahn Chah's wisdom and the monks that I lived with, was they had much more practical understanding of their situations. And so, you know, here I was, I had an MA degree and all that, but, you know, I was quite useless in so many ways. And the monks used to say, Propfrong, those are foreign monks, all they can do is read books and ride in airplanes. Which was their way of insulting, but but in a way it was true. But also, it did, living that kind of life, you know, did, you couldn't just live in a realm of altruist ideals, but in, you had to be very practical. And so, like, the training in the Vinaya was all about, just about, you know, ordinariness, and it wasn't based on ideals and high-minded thoughts, but just on agreed ways of behaving. And then the idea of conforming to a tradition, to a set of rules, was totally against my conditioning. I remember even then, when I was a teenager, I read a book by Alberto Moravia called The Conformist, and that's what I'm not going to be, as a conformist. I deliberately prepared myself to be a nonconformist. And so it started out, teenager, kind of rebelling and being a nonconformist, and you know, thinking that this is, you know, the people that conform to conditions and structures and that were stupid. And this is another kind of conceit that nonconformists have, when they look down on conformists. And then, of course, the irony of that is finding myself in the most conservative conforming conditions probably in the world. But the other did, you know, it, by the time I was 30, the effect of living in that way was I was depressed. I lost self-respect. I was just following desires and seeking pleasure and getting by. I hadn't really, you know, I learned how to get by and you know, but I hadn't been living in a way I could respect. It, you know, it has its fun and its pleasures and advantages, but at the end of the day, I was quite depressed by it. And so that's why, one of the reasons why I became a Buddhist monk. Because I thought, if I have to, on my 30th birthday, I was in the Peace Corps in Sabah, North Borneo, and my 30th birthday came about. And that, I think that's quite a significant birthday for most people, when you realize your youth is definitely the past. and suddenly it dawned on me, you know, that I couldn't stand to live 30 more years in the way that I was living, that I had not prepared or not ready for anything other than than just distracting myself. And I thought 30 more years of endless distractions would be, you know, I've already fed up with it at 30. By the time I'm 60, I'll be probably be dead or a drug addict or something. So I, you know, in the Peace Corps, I was fortunate enough. Before that, I was in, my interest lie with Zen Buddhism. That was what was available in the Bay Area at that time. And there was no real interest in Buddhism as such. And I'd looked around in San Francisco and the surrounding areas for teachers of meditation and couldn't find any. And so then the opportunity to join the Peace Corps. I was in Peace Corps training when President Kennedy was assassinated. And so that was, we all had great hopes when Kennedy was elected. And then, of course, he was murdered. And I went off to Sabah, which is a northern part of Borneo Island. It was a British colony before. And just as we arrived in the beginning, January of 1964, that it had been relinquished from the colonial, as a colony put into the Federation of Malaysia. So now it is Sabah and Sarawak were the two British colonies on the island of Borneo that are part of, they're called East Malaysia. But it was there that I was taught English in a Chinese school in a small port town. And then I think those 2 years, it was in this very kind of beautiful area, like a tropical paradise. And for 2 years I had, you know, I had so much fun. It was teaching these Chinese kids. They were all young, and Chinese children were much more obedient, respectful than American. Much easier to teach. And then we had quite a social life, and with scuba diving and all kinds of things, like an endless party of pleasure and fun. And yet still, during those 2 years, I managed to suffer, not because of any external things, but I could just see I just created problems in my mind. Didn't have anyone to blame there but myself. It was very obvious. So then I knew nothing about Theravada Buddhism at the time, but because of being in Southeast Asia, I had holiday time where I went to Thailand and Cambodia. And so I was very much impressed when I entered Thailand, because it is a Buddhist country, and as soon as you cross the border from Malaysia, then you've seen stupas and saffron-robed monks and the whole thing, wherever you go, you know. I took the train from Singapore up to Bangkok, 1966. And then I also had written away to Buddhist Publication Society in Kandy for literature, and the World Fellowship of Buddhists in Bangkok. And in Kuala Lumpur, there is a Sinhalese monk called Sri Dhammananda, who's one of the amazing bhikkhu who really brought the attention to people there towards Theravada Buddhism. Because most of the Buddhists there are Chinese, and they would mostly be of their traditional Chinese styles of Mahayana Buddhism mixed with Tao and Confucianism. And Sri Dhammananda really had a profound effect. And that these days, Malaysia, there's an enormous interest in Theravada, which wasn't there when I lived there. And then, so after the Peace Corps, I went to Thailand and became a monk. And this this was, you know, my decision that the only thing, by that time, the only real interest I had in life, I was not ambitious in a worldly way. I didn't have any worldly ambitions. So I didn't know what to do with my life. At that time, I didn't want to be a school teacher. I didn't want to go back to university. I didn't want to get married. What to do? And so so then Thailand offered this unique opportunity to... I started meditating in somebody, a German hippie had given me address of a temple in Bangkok that taught Vipassana. So I went there and started meditating. And then in that year I became a samanera, and 1967 took bhikkhu ordination. So that's the you know, how one, you know, once I was ordained, it seemed like opportunities opened up for me in a way I never expected. Where when I ordained, I was quite unhappy and confused, and then and life hadn't been going very well for me. I mean, it was, you know, it was really quite, I think, in a state of some kind of depression. So, and then becoming a Buddhist monk in Thailand, suddenly it seemed like doors opened up, opportunities became rushing towards me. Found a very good teacher, Ajahn Chah, and my life ever since has been one, it seemed like you know, some kind of blessing that happens, you know, when you open yourself up to that. And so then, of course, in Thailand, it's a Buddhist country. About 95% of the Thai people would identify with Theravada Buddhism. You know, so you've got this homogeneous society, and they all see themselves as Thai, Theravada, and Buddhists. There's no other country that has such homogeneity, and you know, like even Sri Lanka has large minorities, but in Thailand it was, and that maybe 5% of the population would be Muslim, Christian, and animistic religions. But because of that, Thai Buddhism was all over the place. It had so many, you know, it had been established for so long, part of a culture. So it had, you know, it ranged from the very best to the very worst. And then, fortunately, I was able to find somebody like Lungpo Cha, who was a strong force in bringing attention to Thai people, what the Buddhist teaching really is. So, and this is why he's so highly revered now, even though he's been dead 20 years. He's you know, he really knew how to inform people. He was not a divisive monk or, you know, one who created more problems for the Thais, but he also understood their psychology and how to work within the system very well and how to, you know, really inform them of what is. This is the Buddhist teaching, this is Brahmanism, this is animism, and so forth, because, you know, in many people's minds, all mixed up in one pot. There's also, at that time, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu in the southern Thailand, who is very clear and precise and very informative in educating people about what the Buddhist teaching really is. So then in the monastery of Lungpo Cha, of course, he was quite strict with the Vinaya. Well, a lot of a lot of monasteries in Thailand aren't. And so this, you know, one can be, you know, rule-keeping and strict rules can make one in a very conceited kind of person. So, but Lungpo Chaw also had a very, you know, this emphasis on mindfulness and observing suffering and its causes. So throughout my life, due to that, I've been, you know, aware of my own grasping and the results of grasping and my own critical tendencies or, you know, my own personal way I tend to react to restraint or restriction or other people, conventions and onward, to observe how that affects, you know, be the observer of the emotional reactions that I experience. So that that led me to, in 1977, to go to England. And there, it's been, you know, another 33 years there where, you know, you're in a situation, a very special situation, where you are the focus of a lot of praise and blame. And then you have to deal with things that I, you know, like property and regulations and all the rest. The annoying, irritating frustrations of bureaucracy. And but actually, it hasn't been, you know, there's a lot of interest in Europe now in Buddhist teaching, because I feel it, there is, you know, a great need for this kind of, we need this as a balance to our own deluded tendencies towards always progress and trying to attain and achieve and emphasize our individuality, you know, where I become the most important thing in my life and what I think. And it's even now even more so with internet. Everybody can give forth their opinions that spread all over the universe, and I hear are there forever. So any moron can say anything they want on the internet. And it goes all over the world. And so there's not a sense of right speech or responsibility or sense of respect, but everybody has a right to say what they think. And that's the way it is now with the you know, in my lifetime I've seen the changes from, you know, what, you know, I was born in 1934 during the Depression and Second World War onward. And the change, say, in the United States from being, you know, a country where it, you know, it didn't have that sense of being a superpower when I was young. It still had that kind of, it was more, you go to New Zealand now and you feel it was more like it's more like America was in the 30s and 40s. And mentally, you know, because they don't have they have no sense of themselves as being a superpower, do they? And there's not much chance of becoming one. Right? I mean, they have a kiwi as their national symbol. Where the United States has a predatory ego, you know. But also this interest, like the Buddha, like people have asked me in England, you know, why are you Buddhist? It's an old religion. It's past its prime. And then, you know, you meet people that have modern versions, like I remember meeting some Baha'i people, and they were saying, well, Buddha was right for his time, but it, you know, he's kind of, it's past that time. And Jesus was right for his time. And they've been incredibly patronizingly tolerant. Mohammed was right for his time. But now the latest, he says, we have Baha'u'llah. He's the latest. That's what they told me. And I thought, this sounds exactly like something I don't want to become involved with. Because, you know, I've often wondered why at this time where Buddhist teachings have been mainly ignored in the Western world ever since it spread. You know, it seemed to take root in Asian countries, but it never seemed to take root in the West, in the European areas, or in the Middle East, or any place like that, Egypt. But and then it can be seen as just a kind of part of Asian religion. And then as being brought up as a Christian, you know, we were told that all other religions were wrong. So there's a whole, you know, all religions were dismissed as wrong and Christianity was right. So that is, you know, the kind of cultural background I'm from, where you just dismiss something that you know nothing about, and just believe that what you have is right, and anyone who doesn't have that is wrong. So, and then because of my character, which is quite skeptical, I became aware of that quite young, and was quite appalled by that. You know, I could see in the church that I went to, people dismissed things they knew nothing about and condemned things, you know, just on the basis that it didn't fit into the narrow parameters of their beliefs. So, and that's one reason for being a nonconformist, that's conformed. But the conformity here isn't out of fear or ignorance, but it's deliberate choice to investigate, you know, one learn to simplify one's life. Actually, like the monastic Vinaya, it looks complicated, you know, when you look at it in the scripture, but it actually is like it simplifies your way of living and how we live with each other, so that different characters, personalities, and that can manage to survive with each other in a reasonable way because of the Vinaya. And if we didn't have that, then it would be each one for themselves, you know. And like Amaravati in England, you've got, you know, a monastery of strong characters that we couldn't possibly live with each other for very long if it was just my opinion against yours. And so it's because of this commitment willingness to respect this discipline that we manage to live in harmony with each other. Well, that's quite a lesson for someone who was brought up in a totally different way. You know, so it's going against the whole cultural expectation of my own cultural background. Then the wisdom, like Buddha Dhamma, is about wisdom, and that we don't have in the West. We have, you know, our societies are based on ideals of how things should be, and so we're always, you know, we're always seeing what's wrong and complaining and blaming because we know how things should be, or we're blaming ourselves. We're seeing we hold ourselves up to a high standard, idyllic standard, and never able to succeed in really living up to it. So then we feel guilty and despairing and worthless. Where in terms of Buddha Dhamma, you know, just getting to know the what it is to be human, have a human form, which is not ideal. You know, it's a natural form from this planet. It's based on, you know, survival, fear, survival, procreation, you know, sensitivity. It's all about feeling and being sensitive. And there's a lot to fear, you know, in this realm. It's a fear realm that we're living in. And you can see it in the, you know, in the forests, in the jungles, survival of the fittest. And they had these Richard Attenborough DVDs, you know, where Planet Earth. And that they're beautifully done, you know, where you see how, you know, endless survival of species, one feeding on the other. And yet there's something stunningly beautiful, but also horrifying about it, that this is the realm that we're actually a part of, this survival realm, in sensitive realm, in a universe that is a mystery that we can't really get any great perspective on because of the limitation we have of our form and our karma. So then this Buddhist teaching takes that into account. So we're coming from here and now, from this form here, these feelings that I can observe in myself at this time, you know, and observing them in the sense not of criticizing or comparing them with ideal things, but recognizing they are what they are, conditions arising, ceasing, changing. All conditions are impermanent. And through that continuous investigation, more and more you find your refuge in awareness, which is not a created state. It's not like dependent on conditions to be a certain way. It's you know, when you begin to recognize it and value it, then you know it's here and now, wherever, whatever's happening, whatever state you are mentally, physically, or whatever place you're in. The mindfulness is always our escape from suffering in the present moment. And it's through this this reminding, remembering, that we have developed or have this sense of bhavana, or developing mindfulness, not which isn't about me having more mindfulness, but the sense of me letting go of the conditions more and more to where the refuge is in mindfulness, in attention, in a conscious awareness, and then the wisdom, ability to discern, see the difference between, you know, you can recognize the conditioned as a condition. You discern it, and whatever the conditions might be, it'd be anything. And there's also discerning the unconditioned, the unborn, the Amata Dhamma is this. This is this very center, this witnessing, this ability we have within these mortal forms to recognize the Dhamma, the Paramatta Dhamma, ultimate reality. I think that's enough.
Nandamayang dhamma uvata katha sadhu kalang tathamase.